old-fashioned, like she's just a little woman. Of course, I have no idea who her husband is. Then, today... Gwen stopped as Dan's BlackBerry buzzed. He eyed the message, snickered, answered it with rapid-fire thumbing, and laid the thing down, looking at it lovingly.
Sorry.
Are you gonna guess?
Wait, what was the story?
Gwen rolled her eyes. Never mind. I'll tell you, okay? John Curtis. John Curtis is a father at our school. You remember him? She mimed, pushing the hair back, the arrogant, pouty expression. From freshman year. See, I was in math with him.
What?
Before she even clarified the reference, Dan was all attention, his eyes sharp and inquisitive behind the wire rims.
At school? What do you mean? What school?
Gwen gave him a look. St. Timothy's.
St. Tim's?
Dan repeated with an obtuseness so uncharacteristic, Gwen felt a pang of fear.
Yeah, his kid's there.
Well? She amended. It's not his kid. His stepkid.
Oh.
They were living in London, just moved back. He definitely augmented his pretensions whilst there. He's all decked out in those contrast shirts with a white collar and cuffs, leather driving gloves. Gwen shuddered. Men's luxury goods repulsed her more than filth or obscenity did, as if true evil lurked amid the leather backgammon sets, the monogrammed humidors and oat shaving kits. Curtis, in his new iteration, seemed the embodiment of all that. Gwen could picture Minnie Curtis presenting her husband with such gifts, knowing they would go over well. Unconsciously, he must have known when he married her that she would get how to do all that. That she would give him that kind of socially sanctioned present and, God knows, not something homemade and heartfelt. And shameful. It was a sort of thing couples agreed on without necessarily knowing they agreed. A certain type of man needed a wife to help keep things impersonal, as if marriage were a barracks, and inspection from the outside could come at any time. They somehow managed to muscle in mid-year, she mused. It's funny, because I would have predicted just this trajectory for him, the Teflon ascension to the marble halls of power, though he's not actually the big dude, Gwen conceded. To be fair, he only works for the big dude. Silent and statue still, Dan waited. He's not, you know, the dude collecting the modern art. That's Martin Kerr himself, apparently. Martin Kerr of Invictus Capital. Gwen's voice dripped sarcasm. Invictus Capital? Give me a break. Dan took a paper napkin from the plastic holder in the middle of the table and wiped his mouth.
You guys talk?
He said dryly. Gwen shrugged.
Please, he's so arrogant.
And what can you say to someone like that?
I was just lying there, and he...
The words came into her head again, unbidden. Gwen swallowed, and feeling as if she were prevaricating, she said offhandedly, So you do remember him, right? Vaguely. His food forgotten, Dan seemed to be sizing her up. He was watching her with an intent, considering expression, as if he had only just noticed whom he was married to. He had never told Gwen about the Tamco investigation into Curtis 3 years ago. He had never mentioned it. It was the year they lost the baby, the year in which saying good morning when they passed each other in the kitchen, keeping up a front of normalcy for Mary, seemed to take all he had. Maybe he'd had some notion of presenting her with a triumph. Take one guess who your husband is putting on trial this week. When the investigation foundered, he saw no reason to mention it. They didn't need more disappointment. To deflect Dan's strange scrutiny, Gwen said lightly, Always was such a piece of work, wasn't he? He was in math with me. Started out so uncool, black sneakers, black jeans, reinvented himself as some Euro-trash preppy. Boy, was that a crock. Tried to make the crew team at some point. Failed. Those guys used to make fun of him, remember? Tom Wilmerding and Vint Prince? But then, she said, he started investing money for them, and he was their new best friend. Embarrassing that she could recall details like that, as if she'd had a Robin Leach-type role in college. Lifestyles of the Cool and Legacied, with your host, Gwen Babineau. She was distracted for a second, thinking of Ryan Coughlin, and when she came back to the conversation, she realized that Dan's eyes hadn't moved from her face. A bit self-consciously, she filled him in. As I say, we're having a playdate there. Oh, Dan, the kid is awful.
Mary, of course, doesn't notice, happy to play with anyone. I should be grateful, I guess. This girl, she's one of those kids who wear designer clothing. They say she's redshirting in the fours. Past eligibility, no doubt. She's 5 feet tall. 6 if she's a day, I swear. Really striking looking. These blue eyes and this tan complexion. Not Curtis's. Did I say that? He's the stepdad. I don't know at what point he came into the picture. Crazy to see him after all these years. Not that we were friends. Puerto Rican? Dan's voice was devoid of all emotion, all nuance. Gwen looked curiously at him. He had never sounded so flat, so bored. He cleared his throat and repeated the question, peering into the Pyrex bowl as he scraped out the last spoonful of Uncle Ben's. The wife? Gwen squinted. Yeah, maybe. She did grow up in Spanish Harlem. She went on, though she had no idea why Dan was asking. Or perhaps now she did have. Knew just whence this utterly atypical interest in school gossip sprang, but wanted to keep up the pretense that this was just chatter, help him get whatever he needed out of it. Or at least started there. I got the whole story. Didn't ask for it, but I got it. She offered me a ride home the other day. She doesn't even know me. Maybe took pity on me? She was telling me about her husband, how they met and everything. It's unbelievable to me that the whole time it was John Curtis she was talking about. And when I said Mary and I had to get going, she said to hop in. We could go with her. Her driver came all the way over here. What was the story? Dan said tersely. Gwen tried to remember the facts, which had blurred even in the moment, obscured by the titillating frankness of Minnie Curtis's delivery. Gwen had marveled at the woman's openness before a perfect stranger. Spanish Harlem, then the stepfather moved them out to Long Island, put her in Catholic school. She never knew her father. Mother was an alcoholic. This all came out on one car ride? Dan was skeptical. I'm telling you, she'll tell you anything. Like what else? What else did she say? Well, she never went to college. She was a paralegal when she met her first husband. She's... Gwen searched for the right word, was surprised when it turned out to be so simple. She's proud of it. She radiates pride. When she was telling me about her mother's drinking, I tried to change the subject. Figured, you know, she might not want to get into it. But no. You know what she said? She said, lots of people say their parents drink, but my mother, she was a falling down drunk. She'd go through a quart before breakfast. Minnie had actually slapped her thigh when she said this. It was one of many gestures that seemed more suited to vaudeville than the back seat of a chauffeured SUV. There's more on the stove, Gwen added as Dan continued to scrape absently at the empty bowl. I'll get it. Sure. As she rose, Dan gripped his fork overhand and drilled his plate with it. How long, by the way? He said impatiently. What? How long has John Curtis been a parent at St. Tim's? Oh, a couple weeks. The girl just started right after the break. Gwen went to get the rice. Huh. Gwen turned from the counter and gave Dan a sharp look that he unabashedly stonewalled, not even grabbing the blackberry for an excuse. Here we go. She set the bowl down in front of him. Dan looked up at her as if he had no idea what was going on. What? More rice? Oh, yeah. After a minute, he served himself some. Gwen stood at the counter, slicing into squares the pan of chocolate chip blondies she and Mary had made that afternoon, cutting off a big rectangular chunk for Dan, who had a major sweet tooth. She sometimes wondered if the sweet tooth had come first, and the drinking was only an extension of it, not the other way around. Not that she was complaining. He kept it under control. It was his business. Must have written a big check, huh, to get in? Gwen wasn't convinced. Well, if that were all it took... What do you mean? Oh, come on. She started to spatula the blondies into a tin left over from Christmas. There must be hundreds of people who could write a check. Plenty on the Upper East Side alone who could fork over, what, $50,000 for a spot without even thinking about it? She thought she was just stating the obvious, but Dan said quickly, You think? In this environment? Because last year decimated people, you know. Guys lost their jobs all over the place. Gwen shrugged. People say they knew someone. Curtis. John Curtis knew someone? Dan sounded personally affronted. That guy with a friend at St. Tim's? I find that hard to believe. Yeah? She said lightly, pushing the top down on the tin. Her husband's relative innocence about how the world worked, his funny, persistent blind spots given what he did for a living, could be touching, but worried her a little, too. The big prosecutor, yet she felt that he could be taken advantage of more easily than she could, and that she, and maybe Mary, too, had to protect him from the harsh realities. Maybe all women felt that way about their men. He's in that world now, you know?
I guess.
She brought him his blondie on a plate.
I mean, I get that he has the money now,
Dan said.
But the connection? Even Kerr. Kerr with his billions.
St. Tim's could give a shit about people like Martin Kerr. Gwen let it pass. She was just happy that they were nearly done with the fancy nursery school. Mary had last month taken the gifted and talented test to get into one of the city's better public kindergartens. Gwen was counting on Mary making the cut. And she was counting the days.
Invictus.
She took the plastic broom out of the little vertical pantry at the end of the kitchen.
Isn't that classic?
A bunch of white guys identifying themselves with Mandela's struggle. I couldn't remember the exact connection, so I looked it up. He had it hanging on the wall of his prison cell on Robben Island. The poem, I mean. But I'm sure trying to find the next stock to short is akin to overthrowing apartheid when you think about it, right?
Invictus Capital.
She sniggered. What an asswipe. Dan watched his wife working. He found her efficient, unshowy movements soothing. She began to sweep the strip of linoleum. The smart swish, swish, swish of the broom seemed to focus his thoughts. He came to, wolfing the dessert he'd been handed.
This is good. Thanks.
Mary did all the mixing. She's so good at it now. Gwen dumped the contents of the dustpan into the plastic trash can underneath the sink.
So you're having a playdate with them?
Dan was suddenly in possession of the facts.
With a Curtis kid?
Next week?
Just the one?
Gwen hung up the broom and dustpan and closed the cupboard. I'll invite her back, but I'm sure she won't come.
Right.
Dan drummed his fingers, looked away, looked back at Gwen.
I don't know if I'd, like, become best friends with the Curtises.
Wiping her hands on her jeans, Gwen glanced up, a question in her eyes. She gave a brief nod.
Okay.
His proposal of marriage had not been dissimilar. A question floated. Presently, her answer. And while it pained her at times to realize how many deviations they were from the norm, she never missed him when they were apart, nor, she assumed, did he her. For missing someone seemed narcissistic. They never spoke the words, I love you, to each other, for if you had to say it, you must not mean it. She was thankful for this about them anyway. They didn't need to talk about every little thing. After Gwen went to get ready for bed, Dan stayed sitting at the table to digest, not the meal, but the information.
Curtis, dropping the fuck into the parent body of St. Timothy's.
He'd had no idea. The FBI, of course, had been looking at Curtis's banking records, credit reports, work emails. His personal life wasn't all that relevant to the case. No reason why Frank DiNapoli would have uncovered the connection with Dan's. But when Gwen said the name, Dan felt as he had on this morning's commute when he'd nearly been sideswiped by a delivery truck and had to jump back onto the curb yelling and flailing his arms. Thank God she had mentioned it. Thank God she had run into the scumbag, recognized him, and passed it on to Dan. It wasn't that Curtis's being at the nursery school necessarily affected the case, but there was nothing Dan disliked more than being caught out. He wouldn't have enjoyed showing up at some parent event and running into the man he was pursuing without a little mental prep.
Jeez, no.
Chapter 7. Minnie Curtis didn't let a trifle insult her. The point was to fix the problem, not dwell on it. She had broad reasons for wanting to meet with Philippa. Curiosity, friendship, and one very specific one as well. And she didn't want their meeting to take so long to pull off that she would have to sacrifice the former in service of the latter. So, after being stood up a second time for morning coffee, Philippa had called and said peevishly,
"It's just not going to work,"
as if Minnie were at fault. Minnie had an idea. She switched up the invitation to an early drink one weekday evening.
And, Philippa, where would you...
Le Chien Rouge on 74th.
Great, I'll see you there. It was a relief to Minnie that Philippa Lye bypassed the aggressive niceties the other New York mothers relied on, and that she, Minnie, was fast learning to mimic. The competitive one-upmanship of both parties having no opinions or desires whatsoever could go on for 10 minutes, for multiple emails. You decide. I don't care. No, really. I'll go anywhere. We could go somewhere up here, but not if that's inconvenient for you. Are you sure? You're really sure? Because I don't mind. It hadn't been like that when they lived in London. Minnie, who had a good ear, you didn't get from a San Juan Casario to Park Avenue without one, was picking up the New York conventions as if learning a language again. Her lips forming expressions that were not her own and would never be, forcing herself to practice them in order to gain fluency. I'm fine with anywhere. Whatever you think, really. Honestly, you choose. Philippa, apparently, operated under no such head-ducking compunctions, and so Minnie found herself in the kind of shop-worn velvet banquettes and mirrors French restaurant that women a little older than she, Emily Lewin to name one, pass in the daytime with ironic looks, recalling the weeks in the summer of 95 that they hung out with those French boys who were getting their LLMs at Columbia. She wouldn't have entered the place on her own, although not for the obvious reason that it was past its prime. Minnie didn't give a hoot about eating out. She was perfectly happy having cheese and crackers at home. When she and her husband did have dinner at a restaurant, John liked to go to the famous top-tier places, 21 Club and Le Bernardin, Café des Artistes and Nobu, places Marty Kerr recommended, as if, Minnie noted a little skeptically, they were great finds. Just as well, the more modest establishments made her husband uneasy. He would look nervously around as if he were missing a better party somewhere. He'd been similarly impatient when they looked at apartments that had fewer than 10 rooms or were east of Park. Minnie had to talk him into buying the 2 estate condition classic sixes, one on top of the other, and taking on the job of combining them. He'd want a turnkey, not a project. Think of the value it'll create, she insisted. She had learned to speak his language as well. In a corner of the dark, sparkly room, a gray-haired couple dined with quiet determination. Their age would have made them incongruous in a place such as this, except that no one was incongruous anymore. Minnie had ordered a Manhattan, which she wasn't drinking. Minnie was a teetotaler. Scarred by her mother's alcoholism would have been the knee-jerk analysis. But in fact, she had never liked the taste of booze. It simply wasn't tempting. A cherry Coke was her favorite drink if she could find it. Or Shirley Temple. She kept grenadine and ginger ale on hand at home, and in lieu of supper often arranged cocktail parties for herself and Arabella, replete with Swedish meatballs and scallops wrapped in bacon. But it was the lowest of the low, she felt, and this did come from her mother's tutelage, not to order a drink. The place, and waiting for Philippa in it, reminded her of the Fordyce Crandall girls. She could picture them here a decade ago, the moment when the bar had no doubt peaked, hear their constant ironic laughter. Minnie sighed. The problem with those girls, with most American girls, was that they try to punch above their weight, thinking of their aggrieved plaint. Philippa Lye, Philippa Lye, Philippa Lye. Minnie recalled rather sadly that they had all seemed to think that, given a break here or there, they too, with their wide faces, their pug noses, their strong jaws, their athletic or disproportionate builds, might have been models. Silly girls. But that was America for you, Minnie thought, swirling the dark liquid in the glass but still not drinking. She had gone to New York from Puerto Rico at age 9, ostensibly because her mother was in search of her father, who was white, but really because the woman was bored and wanted to be poor and drink somewhere else. To become a movie star was every teenage girl's right. Indeed, her burden. Minnie had known she would never be a movie star, not in a million years, but, drunk or sober, her mother had loved old movies. She had started Minnie on them, and Minnie tried to comport herself at all times like Grace Kelly in Rear Window. Philippa Lye, of course, had been a model. She had, so the story circulated at the law firm, been big in Japan until some murky incident there had derailed her career for good. But why did this rankle so with the other girls? Minnie had been truly puzzled by their jealousy. The career had run its course, years before any of them had ever even met Philippa, yet it still entered to the bitterness they expressed at the trajectory of the woman's life.
At last, watching them carefully, as if she were an anthropologist set down on the 40th floor of the Citicorp Center to observe the indigenous culture. She had grasped a truth that seemed to illuminate the whole culture of entitlement for her. They felt that they deserved what Philippa had gotten. Despite the wide faces, the long torsos, they thought Philippa's marriage to Jed Skinker unfair. Silly, benighted American girls. An incident from the firm that had disconcerted Minnie came suddenly to mind as she sat waiting happily enough at the bar, rehearsing what she would say to Philippa, how she would broach the important subject of the night. It was something trivial, but she'd never forgotten it, probably because it encapsulated who she, Minnie Cologne, was, and who the rest of them were. Of an overweight but stylish female partner, Minnie had remarked appreciatively, "She does very well with what she's been given." The other girls had laughed, a little scandalized, as they circled the table in the conference room doing document collation. At first, she thought it was the implied reference to God she'd made that had set them off, though she'd purposely not mentioned him by name. She was learning day by day to survive in corporate Manhattan. But no, it was something else. What became clear from their responses was that, while she considered the remark a compliment, they considered it an insult. "Oh, Minnie. Oh, God, Minnie, you really are a piece of work. I'll tell Renata you said that. With what she's been given, I love it." It was against their code, their creed, to acknowledge that some were more blessed than others, that some were more beautiful than others, that some had to work harder for things that others were given at birth. A most basic fact that Minnie had known in her bones since she was 3 or 4, and her mother had taken her to look at the massive motor yachts moored in the San Juan Harbor, but that they didn't seem to teach in American schools. Here, they were all equal. "Let's take a table, shall we? I hate sitting at a bar." 35 minutes late, Philippa gave Minnie a kiss on each cheek. "So affected, I know, but I lived in Paris for a year, and I never got out of the habit." She preceded Minnie to a booth whose royal blue velvet seat was patched with duct tape. On her spiky heels, Minnie teetered into the other side of it and carefully set down a Manhattan. "That must have been fun," she ventured. "Oh, I don't know. The French can be so..." "Mrs. Skinker," the waiter appeared. "Something to drink?" It was an unlikely hour for two mothers to meet, the rest of their ilk home coping with baths and bedtimes. But if either woman felt self-conscious, she didn't show it. Philippa eyed Minnie's glass mistrustfully. "What's that you're drinking?" "Oh, just a Manhattan." "Really? That's a strong drink." She herself ordered straight vodka. "Just one or two ice cubes, Renee." "And some water for me, please," Minnie added. It was all right, she felt, to have some on the side, though her mother had never touched the stuff. "Do you always order Manhattans?" Philippa asked. This very specific curiosity was something Minnie never would have expected from her. "Pretty much since, well, way back, since Fordyce Crandall." She made the conversational leap easily. "I told you I worked there, right?" "No, really? Or wait, did you? So we overlapped." Minnie found it unpleasant that Philippa sat across from her without removing or even untying her coat or taking her handbag from her arm. She had to fight an instinct to admonish her. "No, I started right after you left."
"Did you replace me?"
"No," Minnie admitted. "I wasn't a legal assistant, you see. I was a trained paralegal."
"Oh, you did one of those courses and everything?"
"Correct. I went to school for it."
"So those girls started drinking Manhattans after I left. When I was there, it was all cosmopolitans, Megan and Jen and the rest."
Philippa's focus on the point confused Minnie. "Oh, I wouldn't know what they drank. I didn't really socialize with them."
"No.
No, almost never," she added genially. "But I do know they were very jealous that you'd left to get married. It was all they talked about."
"Really?"
Philippa sounded irritated. "Very jealous." Minnie could still hear the teeth gnashing 9 years later.
"How odd. Why should they care if I got married?"
Most unfair of all, Minnie had gathered, Jedediah Skinker had seemed to materialize out of Philippa's vision of herself. There had been an air of inevitability about the union, of its having been arranged offstage, without anyone's having been consulted or having had a crack herself. That, too,
had driven the girls mad.
They didn't even like me. Of course, I tried to be friendly to all of them.
I was friendly.
Oh, so you socialized with them?
Minnie interrupted. She couldn't picture Philippa at one of those midtown lunches, finishing off the share dessert.
Well, no, Philippa said. But in the office, I mean, I was as friendly as could be.
Minnie said firmly in her rather formal English, hoping to clear up the matter so she could move on. Anyway, it was not the Fordyce girls, but a man who introduced me to Manhattans. The real purpose of this conversation, Minnie would reveal, as soon as she was able to do so decorously. She wanted to get onto the landmarks board that the Skinkers were all over. She would have to introduce the topic subtly, skillfully. John had put her onto it, said he thought it would be nice for her. She knew what he meant was that it would be nice for him, but that was all right. He made the money after all. She had no illusions.
Old boyfriend?
Philippa guessed. Minnie made a face. I wouldn't say that. He was a blind date. One of the secretaries set me up. Carly, remember her? The one who sat at the end with the permed hair? Philippa's eyes went large.
Yes, I do. Gosh, she set you up?
Yes, said Minnie, not understanding the outsize reaction. On a blind date?
No.
Philippa gave a laugh.
That's amazing. I thought people only went on blind dates in movies.
Minnie looked blank.
I went on dozens, she frowned. You have to meet people somehow.
Well, I guess so. Yes, of course you do. He hired a car. He took me out to Peter Luger's. She gave a tight-lipped little smile. I was very young. I didn't know it was fancy. I was really mad at first that I'd gotten dressed up and had my hair blown out, and I was wearing these incredible shoes. And then he tells the driver we're going to Brooklyn. But when we got there, I saw one of the partners. A whole table of them, probably, but I recognized only the one.
Luger's? God, I haven't been there in ages. A creamed spinach.
Minnie found interruptions impertinent, so rather than engage with them, she simply waited for the interrupters to stop talking.
The consistency of pudding.
Sorry, go on.
My date ordered for us,
Minnie recalled fondly. Of course I let him choose, and he ordered Manhattans. I liked the sound of it, just liked the name. And ever since then, she picked up her drink and gestured with it.
Limo to Luger's, Philippa tutted, probably hoping he'd get you into bed.
Oh, well, he did. Minnie had finally found a comment she could warm to, girl to girl. The exchange so far had felt stilted, but she was relieved that Philippa, someone, had at last alluded to sex. She was beginning to think it was never spoken of on the Upper East Side.
Did he?
Philippa looked taken aback.
Did he now?
Oh, yes, please. I figured, well, I supposed he deserved it. He ordered a very expensive bottle of wine. It cost $400, and some champagne. I don't remember the name of it, but he said it was better than Dom Perignon.
I'll bet he did.
Minnie didn't know what Philippa was implying by that, so she said nothing.
So why didn't you see him again? I mean, if you liked him enough to...
Oh, I didn't like him. Minnie corrected her gently, though he was a very nice man. Minnie had nothing to hide, but she hadn't the faintest idea why Philippa was interested in one of dozens of blind dates she'd gone on a decade ago. She had met so many men then, gone on so many dates, and had quite a run if she did say so herself. She had settled for her first husband, Tony, and Tony had led her to John. But that was then. She wanted to steer the conversation toward the request that she was going to make, to at least get Philippa started talking about landmarks protection.
Did he not call you afterward?
Minnie gave a short sigh, the closest she got to audible impatience with the topic.
Yes, he called me. He called me 2 or 3 times.
Philippa seemed to be waiting for her to elaborate, so she said succinctly, I declined the invitations.
But why?
Philippa leaned across the table. She dropped her voice.
Were you embarrassed to see him again?
Embarrassed? Minnie said. Why would I be embarrassed?
Well, I don't know. I mean, after you slept with him.
So? Minnie was tittering, a hand to her mouth.
Well,
she breathed through her nose, trying not to laugh.
The fact was, he was obese.
What?
Philippa's astonishment carried. The gray-haired woman looked up reprovingly from her table, and the bartender and waiter glanced over from the bar. But she didn't mute her voice as she went on.
"You mean, like, hugely obese?"
Minnie paused. "I don't know what qualifies as hugely, but he probably weighed 300 pounds. Or maybe 400? It's hard to tell, isn't it, after they reach a certain point? At the restaurant, he had to take the banquette, I remember that. And I had to take the chair because he told me he had broken too many chairs." She added placidly, "His physical appearance was quite different, actually, from how he had been described to me." Philippa seized her vodka as it arrived.
"So you slept with him, even though he was obese because you felt he deserved it?"
"He was a very nice man," Minnie hastened to say. She didn't want to give the impression that she was spoiled and ungrateful. "He was an industrialist," she said, taking pleasure in the memory, as she did in the memory of most of her dates, blind or otherwise, from the years when she had been on the make. Those had been fun, exciting days, of newness and expectation, of at last putting to use everything one had learned. "I learned that word that night, industrialist."
"As well as to order Manhattans," Philippa said in a marveling tone.
"That's right." Minnie raised her glass. "Cheers."
"Oh, cheers."
"I have a confession to make," Minnie announced after putting her mouth on the glass but not really sipping from the drink. She set it down deliberately and clasped her hands on the tabletop, raising her eyebrows mischievously.
"You're the reason I'm here."
She giggled and waved her hand around. "Everything, all of it, it's all because of you."
"Oh, dear," Philippa grimaced. "That doesn't sound good."
"I was living in London, you see. I was married to a person I met at Fordyce, actually. Tony Barrow, did you know him? He was English. He worked in tech." Philippa gave a little shriek.
"Weird Tony," she cried. "Weird Tony from tech. You've got to be kidding me."
"Yes," Minnie said after a minute pause. She hadn't flinched. "Anthony Barrow was my first husband. He is Arabella's father."
"But this is brilliant. It's all coming back to me. I remember Tony. He was my savior when my laptop was on the fritz."
She sat back in the booth, expansive.
"God, what a fantastic place to work that was. I wish I were still there, I tell you. It gave me a sense of purpose, going in there every day. I'm not sure I've ever been happier."
Minnie waited with a pleasant expression on her face.
"Weird Tony, who would have thought?"
Philippa seemed suddenly to remember herself.
"I'm sorry."
She looked as if she'd been rebuked, though Minnie had said nothing.
"What were you saying?"
Minnie unzipped her purse, flashing her beautifully manicured nails, and withdrew a newspaper clipping. She handed it to Philippa, who took it, and frowned. "As I say, I was living in London, and I came across this photograph of you and your husband. You see, I always had to have my New York Times. I had to have the style section. I'd go down to the newsstand in Knightsbridge, and I'd turn right to Styles. And one day, I opened it up. I was at work at the time. Arabella was in preschool, and I was getting bored sitting around at home, so I'd started a temp job just that week in Mayfair at a hedge fund. Because the regular secretary was having a baby, and I must have gasped or something, because I was so thrilled to see this photograph. The Philippa Lye, whom I'd heard so, so much about from the other girls. And the absolute boss of the whole place happens to be walking by. He gives me a grin and says, 'Something good in the news?' He comes over to my desk, and he's got one hand on either side of me on my desk. I'm quaking. I'm so nervous. Here I am, this little temp, and I say, 'You see them?' And I point, and I say, 'I know her. We used to work together.'" Before Philippa could react, Minnie said hurriedly, "I know I didn't really know you, but it seemed like I did. I'd heard so much about you from Jen and Megan and Marnie. They talked about you constantly. I knew about your modeling career. It really felt as if we'd met. I'd always looked to see if I knew anyone in Styles. I figured one of them would make it into the wedding section, and instead there you were. Mr. and Mrs. Jedediah Skinker arriving at the Winter Ball." The Landmarks Protection Society. She could recite the caption by heart. "The next day, John, he was Mr. Curtis to me then, started asking me all of these questions about you. Well, and about Jed. John knew about the bank, of course. Everyone knows Skinker Farr.
and I told him what I knew, that you'd been a model and left the law firm when you got married. Minnie eyed her companion to see how her flattering rendition of the story was going over. Philippa was still looking across the table in Minnie's direction, but she had gone blank. Minnie's story seemed to be having no effect on her whatsoever. She sipped her vodka. "Swept off your feet by Jed Skinker." Minnie hesitated, suddenly unsure of herself. Usually, there was nothing a woman liked better than having the story of how she met her husband recounted. "How is Jed?" she said, as perkily as she could manage, in an attempt to bring Philippa back in, adding with a kind of performative little flourish she liked, "How is Mr. Skinker?" She raised her glass to her lips, and this time took one real, distasteful, but necessary sip of her drink. "He's never at school, is he? Jed? I don't know why he would be, but it would be fun to meet him one day." Even Renee, the waiter, appearing at Philippa's quick signal for another, must have noticed that for Mrs. Skinker the name had the quality of a taboo. She turned her head away. "He's fine." "How are his hours?" Minnie said sympathetically, feeling she had found firmer ground. "Are they terrible? He must work a ton. Family bank and all. Johns are the worst. Weekends, he travels a lot, too. I don't mind, though. I figure it takes what it takes. And I don't mind a night off, you know. I know they really value him. I mean, Marty, obviously. Marty really values him. When we wanted to move back from London, just to, I don't know, start over, you know, newly married couple, I didn't want to live in Tony's country forever. It seemed depressing. England is depressing. It's not the weather, it's the darkness. Nobody tells you that. Anyway, John wanted to move, too. The next thing you know, we're moving back. He just sorted the custody right out with Tony. How'd you do it, I asked him. How'd you get him to agree to it? I can be so naive. How the... Minnie lowered her voice. F, do you think I did it? He says. Money. Can't you get it through your head? Money. You just have to spend the money. Self-conscious about hogging the airspace, Minnie made another attempt to draw Philippa out. How about your Jed? What's his view on all that? When Philippa didn't answer, now gazing into the middle of the room, her hand clasped around the stem of her glass as if to anchor it to the table, Minnie said warmly, "It must be strange, having your name on a bank." Now Philippa spoke up, to demur. "Oh, my name's not on the bank. I never changed it. I'm still Lie." Minnie gave a cozy little scoff, thinking to flatter Philippa. "That's pretty literal, isn't it?" "What?" "I mean, for all intents and purposes, you are Mrs. Jed... excuse me, Mrs. Jedediah Skinker." Minnie signaled to the departing waiter, who had just brought Philippa's second vodka. "I'll have another as well." The man looked in a non-comprehending way at Minnie's full glass. Minnie laughed. "No, I know, but this'll go. And I want to keep Philippa company. I don't want to leave her on her own, stranded."
This gesture did not seem to affect Philippa one way or the other.
She had withdrawn a matchbook from a coat pocket and was turning it over in her long fingers. "And my point, what was I saying? Oh, yes, you are Mrs. Jedediah Skinker, and Skinker is the family bank."
"But I'm not involved," Philippa said in a small voice.
"Well, perhaps, but
I've never paid any attention to it at all."
"You shouldn't admit that." Minnie laughed nervously. "Why, Philippa, tisk tisk, you should never admit that. It's like saying your husband isn't worth anything to you. My God, I would never say something like that about John. These guys, they're out there every day fighting. We have to appreciate them, or who else will, right?"
Philippa started to rummage in her bag. It was an oversized hobo-type sack, the gray leather aged, smooth, and mottled with stains.
"Well, anyway," Minnie said in a placating tone, "technically, your name may not be on the bank, but your children's names are. Your children, what is it, Ruth, yes? She is so adorable. Arabella just loves her, wants a playdate ASAP. Please, Mommy, when can we have the little Skinker girl over? Ruth and Sebastian is the boy, I know, and what's your older girl, Laura? Laura, isn't it? They're Skinkers, after all. Their names are on the bank anyway, their names."
Philippa rummaged at length, with increasing agitation coming up at last, to Minnie's surprise, with a prescription bottle. She pressed the top down with her palm, opened it, and tipped out two pills. Dismayed, Minnie said hurriedly,
The building is so beautiful, the most beautiful bank in New York. Wow! But of course, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, I've noticed the Skinkers are very involved in the Landmarks Protection Society. It seems like such a good cause. She stopped. Philippa's eyes watered as she raised her chin and choked down the pills.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh, Minnie said. Don't worry about it.
One of those days, I'm afraid.
Philippa seemed to attempt a smile.
I was late for pickup.
She reached for a water glass, her hand hesitating above Minnie's.
Again.
Help yourself. Of course, finish it. Philippa drank, and her eyes flashed up to Minnie.
I'm a terrible mother.
What? Don't be silly. Minnie made the obvious rebuttal. You have 3 children.
I thought.
There was a funny catch in Philippa's voice as she said,
safety in numbers, you know.
Oh, my God, are you crying? Minnie could have kicked herself for letting the conversation descend to this. She had mismanaged it, but she couldn't think how. Usually people like to talk about themselves. Shielding her eyes with a long, slender hand, Philippa said,
we had a fight, you see, and then he had to go.
Minnie reached out and patted Philippa's equally long, slender forearm, which lay lifelessly on the table. It's going to be fine. Don't even think about it. Just put it out of your head. Hey, all couples fight, right? John can be an absolute dick to me. He can be an asshole. She looked around and raised her hand for the waiter. Coffee? She mouthed. Then she gave a forced titter. Sometimes I think John loves his boss more than me. Never mind that his boss practically propositions me every time he sees me. Philippa said nothing, her eyes downcast. When the coffee came, she drank it without seeming to notice it. Gently, but firmly, Minnie brought her back to the subject of the Landmark Society Board. It had taken too many attempts to arrange this meeting to let it pass by without getting at least part way to her goal. She spoke again of the beauty of the Skinker building on 54th Street. It must have been in your family for, what, a century? Since it was built, no? How cool is that?
Oh, no, they bought in the 70s, when things were going cheap.
Minnie could have screamed. Nothing was ever as it should be. The Skinkers had just gone and bought it when it was cheap. Everyone had told her they'd built it. Everyone was always wrong. She managed to press on. Well, that's even better. A real New York real estate tale. My husband would love that, just love it. He always says he got me on the cheap.
I'm sorry, Philippa said abruptly. I've just realized I've got to go.
You do? Half in shock, Minnie mentioned the board straight out. She was going on trying to smooth over the request when Philippa interrupted.
Oh, okay, sure. There's a donation you have to make.
Minnie blinked. She felt as if she'd had the wind knocked out of her.
Think it's 20,000. It might be 50. Fuck, it might be 100. I'll find out for you.
Well, I can't thank you enough. But Philippa was rising, had never taken off her coat. She was halfway to the door, the bag bumping against her leg. She was flapping slowly out like a huge gray bird of prey. Alone, Minnie wanted to cry. She took an actual real gulp of the Manhattan, but it was so disgusting it only made her want to cry more. The waiter appeared, though she hadn't summoned him, and forcing her lips into a smile, she realized she had been stuck with a check. Chapter 8 In the big field at the farm, there was an oval-shaped depression surrounding the 2 great sycamores. As if growing to their massive size these past 200 years, the elegant giants had tamped down the earth between them. After more than a day's rain, water ponded there. What had been a pleasure as a child, it wasn't mere puddle-stomping, Jed remembered, but wading and splashing in the shallow water, lying down in it, egged on by his sister Sally and his cousins, to approximate a forward crawl, now bothered him a little, for he saw it as a fault in the farm's drainage. How to solve it, though? Soil removal and relocation wasn't his thing. Too much like the Burbs. The junior bankers always talking of landscaping with an avaricious glint in their eyes, as if they couldn't wait to power plant half a dozen non-indigenous saplings, get their hands on their semi-annual dump of bark mulch. Landscaping in the Hamptons. Jed chuckled to himself. Nobody had found his idea for a reality show all that funny.
He glanced at the row of casement windows that made up the southern side, the street side of his office. It was a day for staying in, for keeping one's head down and doing the work, for giving the city its due, rendering unto Caesar. February gray with a cold rain falling. His eye, shrewd and bulging, fell to the paper he was reviewing, a prospectus for an upcoming stock offering, to the section entitled Risk Factors. In this particular post-crash winter, the phrase had the ring of pathos. Closing the barn door after the horses had escaped, they were all thinking about risk factors now. He himself thought of nothing but. He himself was nothing but. He turned the page of the document. He'd always liked that metaphor. Oddly, one did run to close the door of an empty stall. A very large, fair man with a high collar and tufts of darkening blonde hair. He sat hunched over the Regency partner's desk. The desk seemed to be lodged into his bulk rather than the other way around. As a young man, Jed had outgrown his father by 4 inches, the height more from his mother's side. And after college, when he quit rowing, he had put on 30 pounds. Hugh Skinker had been scrappier, with the impatient, clear conviction you expected from men of his era. A quick man, his father, but not a contemplative one. From a generation that had tipped, but not over-tipped. Nothing to feel guilty about. Jed glanced toward the windows again, but he couldn't actually make out the rain. Only the suggestion of rain. A flicker in the light that alerted you to the fact that it was coming down. Skinker Farr was housed in an ornate mid-block mansion on 54th Street, between 5th and 6th. Jed's office was on the 5th floor, top floor, but one. 6, with its pitched roof, housed the presentations department. The running joke that you had to be under 5'4" to work in presentations. It would have made for a neater story if, as rumor had it, the Skinkers had built the Beaux-Arts edifice themselves. It had gone up in 1907, a year when Ionic columns, wrought iron balconies, and carved grotesques served the same purpose as Sub-Zeros and Viking ranges today. When Jed disabused clients of the notion that his family had commissioned it, and explained that his grandfather had shelled out $100,000 in 1973 for the thing, they looked a little green before they swallowed, and congratulated him on Grandfather Reg's foresight. Eventually, he stopped telling the story. The truth was, people didn't want to go back in time to stop Hitler. They wanted to scoop up Manhattan real estate on the crazy cheap, see Dylan in a cafe, maybe. A Beaux-Arts example of the Renaissance Baroque, his father had been determined he should know the provenance. Hugh had also collected all the art on the walls, starting with a vast, Jed could tell you obsessive, collection of works on paper, most of which now adorned the basement, home to the IT department and the print shop mailroom. More of a Georgian man himself, Jed would no doubt have missed the opportunity. Reg's Folly, the family had called the building in the first decade, before the investment came up trumps. Jed still called it that. Going down to the folly of a morning. Hugh had worked tirelessly to have the thing landmarked, even joining the board of the Preservation Society to push the status through. It could never be raised. A son's mandate, and also perhaps his limitation, to preserve. What then was his son's mandate? To flourish in the new millennium, as websites for everything from Harvard to health clubs were fixating on these days.
Millennium? Hell, he'd take a decade. 2010 seemed a long way off today.
Melancholy mood he was in. Blame the rain. There was a muted knock on the door, and Carol Ann came in. She had a shy habit of never quite meeting one's eye.
That research you wanted, Mr. Skinker?
Thank you, Carol Ann. He watched her close the door behind her.
A tall woman, statuesque, with the old-fashioned grace that comes of adolescent instruction in posture.
She had started with his father straight out of secretarial school and never married. Miss Ritchek then and now. It wasn't the kind of thing Hugh would have thought about, but Jed had surmised there was poverty in her background, and some amount of chaos. An adolescent vow fulfilled, perhaps, to make one's own money and keep to oneself. He found his place in the document again. The risk factor stated herein. Good name for a horse, Risk Factor. Risk Factor by something or other out of genuine risk. The filly that won the Derby in 1980. They'd watched it on the tube set up in Billy Flood's apartment above the barn, his mother cheering full throttle. A little frightening when she got like that. Wanted the girl to win.
ice cubes rattling in a tumbler of Billy's whiskey. Go! Go, go, go!
He cheering, too, but 12-year-old Sally covering her eyes, afraid there'd be a broken leg, a horse destroyed. He did a Howard Cosell imitation and made them all laugh. He finished the paragraph, moved on to use of proceeds. It was a coup, that's all he could call it. That Chip Noyes had managed to get a firm of this size, awarded this mandate in the worst market they'd seen since Grandfather Reg came to work in November of 29. No question Noyes was his biggest talent. No rainmaker, Jed. No pretense of being one. The men relieved when he took the helm 13 years after Hugh died and switched them over to straight commissions, 25% to 30%, and it hit their accounts the day a deal was done. He'd gotten a few things right before he made one very specific wrong turn. Rainmaker. It appealed to Jed as an accolade, for he didn't believe so much in a god as in nature. Hard to remember her in the city. Seemed immaterial, what passed for seasons here. Hollywood set with the rain switch turned on outside his window. Rain would have stopped in Danforth by now. The sky over the big field would be lifting. Drizzle petering out, chased along by a new front from the east. Only spatters blown from trees now. Not sure how he knew, but he knew. The weather vane on the barn, hoarse and sulky. The horse trotting due west, mane flying. Mane always flying. He glanced back to the risk factors. He was turning obsessive-compulsive in his 44th year. Volatility in our revenues and profits could fluctuate materially. I'll say. He exhaled with a fed-up noise. There was nothing to be done about that. He wore no watch and eyed the French clock that sat on the carved wood mantelpiece above the room's fireplace. Jed loved the building with the ironic love a man has for a mistress. Conscious it didn't represent him, he loved it all the more, the way Philippa secretly loved the mod cons she'd been deprived of as a kid in Dunning. Color televisions with remote controls, ice makers, heat in cars that actually worked. But he loathed the clock. He mistrusted anything gilt or fanciful, possibly anything French. He loathed objet, period, but kept it as a sort of caution against excess. The desk he cherished, its ink-stained serge top where both Hugh and Reg had scribbled, and that he refused to replace despite Carol Ann's yearly exhortations. Genuine risk. Genuine risk. Phil like a loose horse the night he met her. A loose horse that knows its freedom won't last and so doesn't know what to do with it, stopping to tear mouthfuls of grass here and there but not settling to graze. The whites of her eyes showing, the quick skitter away, the deflection when people crowded in, fake right, fake left. A fine, nervy creature, not delicate, nor overfed, rangy like a point-to-pointer. When he spied her walking out of the bar, she tried to pretend she didn't see him. Breedy creature giving the horse van the miss. What horse van? Circling around. Where? Took handling, the type did, to get them up the ramp without balking. His mind would wander. Defense mechanism, no doubt. Bank and farm. Farm and bank. The two strains in his life. Skinker's the bank and Hussey's the farm. His grandfather, Reg Skinker, the New York banker who had married Charlotte Hussey of Danforth, New York, the only child and a girl. People who didn't know better said that Charlotte had married into the bank. The Husseys knew that it was the Skinkers who had married into the farm. Jed and Sally, as Hugh's children, had grown up in the city, their childhood tied to the bank. Jed's cousins, his uncle Reg's daughters, on the farm. Going up to Danforth on weekends, Jed had never wanted to leave. His earliest memories from the barn, the intoxicating smell of the Timothy bales in the hayloft, the hollow, ringing sound of a horse being led out onto the high wooden floor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. When you looked up, as he always had as a boy, you saw a thousand motes in the weak light that streamed from the air-giving cupola above. At the turn of the century, his great-grandfather Thomas Hussey had made improvements to the farm, added the so-called French drains to the barn, cemented the cellar of the main house. Jed knew all this. He had been weaned on it, tutored in the farm's history by Reg Sr. and Jr., grandfather and uncle. Knew the year the new barn had been built over the old, 1848.
But when he recalled this fondly, coming home from Exeter to speak at his grandfather's funeral, Sally was full of questions for him.
What do you mean, new barn? It's really old, isn't it?
And why did grandfather have French everything? Why not use American drains? That seems strange. It was a shock to Jed, one of those moments when the present begins to shade the past for you. Sexist, there was no other word for it. Grandfather Reg and Uncle Reg hadn't taught the girls how to run the place. Oh, Sally and his cousins drove the tractor and heaved bales up onto the truck, same as Jed. They had milked the cows as children, before Grandfather, with a banker's impatience for the bottom line, had thrown up his hands at the relentless demands of dairy and converted to beef, buying the 30 head of belted Galloways the townspeople knew the farm by. But Grandfather and Uncle Reg hadn't bothered to teach the girls how things really worked.
No, Sal, Jed explained. Not French drains from France. Henry Flagg French. He knew our great-grandfather.
The gilt clock ticked and whirred. Foolish thing kept perfect time. Anyone who knew what was going on would have assumed Jed was avoiding, with his line of thought about the farm, the appointment he had to keep this afternoon. If only the information the man wanted could have been supplied over email. Subject line, Jed thought crudely. Next week's big acquisition. Meeting John Curtis of Invictus Capital in person, which Jed had done twice in the course of their year-long association, required him to be reminded of the ignominious fact that a man who chewed gum and played with his hair had so decisively gained the upper hand. This was the third time he would meet him. Ironically, Skinker Farr had been audited a couple months ago. Mostly, the SEC left them alone, blue-chip reputation and all. First time in 3 years they'd come in. Of course, the guy hadn't found a thing. Skinker kept its paperwork in perfect order. Hugh had been obsessive about that. The auditor had been very thorough, checking to make sure they had, five copies of every prospectus for each deal they underwrote. Corporate malfeasance hadn't occurred to the man. Contemplating the meeting this afternoon with a mixture of dread and intense boredom, Jed half wished it had. But it wasn't, thank God. Curtis, who had started Jed obsessing about the farm's drainage today, the habit of thinking about the farm's problems preceded Jed's encountering that man by a decade. The truth was, Jed could think about the farm only by way of its problems, more or less troublesome issues that needed to be addressed. The shed that needed re-roofing. His foreman, Billy Flood's desire for an upgrade to an air-conditioned tractor before next summer. It had long been his way of avoiding confronting head-on his grossly unfair good luck. The girls had turned out not to want the place. When Uncle Reg died, his end the shock to them all that he had contrived to make it. They'd let Jed buy them out, begged him to buy them out. His sister Sally was an Episcopal priest in Danforth, her congregation made up mostly of weekending New Yorkers, whose faltering little church she had saved with her no-nonsense rhetoric from the pulpit. Well, Jeddy, they should be tithing 10% of their income. They want for nothing. The meth heads from the dying industrial town upriver kept her busy with something beyond the diocesan politics of New York State. As for his cousins, Reg's girls, they had disliked growing up on the farm, vocally envying Jed's and Sally's childhood in New York. Maria, the beauty, was married now in Paris. Pam lived 10 blocks down from him on 78th Street, spent summers on Nantucket with her husband and stepchildren. Sally, with her ear for injustice, had sensed her uncle's baseless repudiation of his own daughters as girls, observed his turning to Jed as the latter approached adolescence. Jed says he'll take a weekend from his summer job to help with the haying. Says he misses it. Soon as he gets out of Harvard, Jed says he's going to move up to the farm permanently. Jed, who loved the place, was tickled to be tapped. It was only years later that it occurred to him that perhaps his uncle had claimed him for the farm only in order to settle a score. Jed's father, Hugh, had been claimed by Grandfather Skinker for the bank. Uncle Reg frankly overlooked. Though he was the older son, he didn't have the quantitative skills, Grandfather said. The old man had been right about that. Reg had very nearly leveraged the place into non-existence, an angry, almost willful heedlessness in the debts he had taken on, the schemes he had invested in, as if, like most denigrated children, he'd been determined to prove his father right. Jed discovered all this when, as a single man in his mid-20s, he drove up one wintry morning to the town lawyer's office in Danforth,
and took possession of two houses, a barn, and 500 acres in Ulster County. The week before, his uncle's hunter had colicked after getting into the grain bin. Selfishly, Reg had kept the gelding alive, suffering for 24 hours till the local vet, getting wind of the fact, drove over, reprimanded him, and put the horse down on the spot. In response, Reg had gotten their father's pistol from the study in the main house and shot himself in the horse's stall. A suicide. His uncle. An aberration in their family. All the things that Jed loathed. Selfishness. Drama. Pretension. Although there was suicide, and there was suicide. The act could serve a purpose if it came to that. A joke that year in the alumni magazine,